the criticism and the outrage over just the idea of faith is misplaced. I think you have to acknowledge at some point that we are all just in disagreement over what constitutes good evidence.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. On this episode, inside the mind of someone leaving but who has not left theism. What the hell is God anyway? And what the hell is faith anyway? All coming up on this episode of the Humanist Hour. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett. In this episode, we're going to be talking to a good friend of mine. And this is going to be interesting because this friend of mine is not a Christian. He's not an atheist. He's in that strange area in between. Anybody who has come out of religion knows exactly this area. And I've been there, and I bet everybody else who once believed has been there. Change does not come immediately. It's not something that you automatically wake up one day and say, hey, guess what? I don't believe in God anymore. Or I don't consider myself a Christian anymore. It's a very gradual change. Sometimes it takes years for somebody to go through the cycle. Now, I want to preface this by saying that not all people go through this cycle and come out an atheist. Many people go through this cycle. They may start as a fundamentalist. They may start believing in one religion and end up believing in another religion. They may just end up being a very liberal Christian. They may end up being a theist or may end up being a deist. We don't know. But the point is, it is this path, it is this journey that people go on that usually starts more on the fundamentalist side and ends up on the much more liberal side. So what's interesting about this conversation is we get to look in the mind of somebody that is going through this process, but not just anybody. This guy is a really good friend of mine, and the reason he's a really good friend is because he's a brilliant guy. He's a really smart guy, and he always impressed me, even when I was debating against him as an atheist, and he was a Christian, and he was more of a fundamentalist. He was never a fundamentalist, but he was less liberal, let's just call it that, at the time. And I would get so annoyed and so frustrated because the things he was saying made sense. And he didn't get caught in these fallacies all the time. He didn't say stupid things that could easily be dismissed. He said some really good things, really a lot of things that really made me think. So sometimes it would annoy me, but over time I learned to really respect him, and then we became friends, and our debates kind of took a different tone altogether. So we're going to be talking with this gentleman. His name is Jeremy Chappell. And I've known him for about 4 years. He's been on the debate board that I had called debategod.org. I actually shut it down. I don't know if I mentioned this before on the show, just because I got so sick of debating and I got so sick of reading all the nastiness that appeared on this board from both sides. It was just a really nasty place where people got mean. So I didn't want anything to do with it. I didn't want to promote it, so I shut it down. But many friendships remained from my time on that site, both from atheists and Christians, mostly Christians, actually. And this gentleman started out as a Christian, and he's been on a journey, let's just say. And that's what we're going to talk about today. And we're going to talk about a lot of interesting issues, and including defining God and what exactly is God anyway. Talking about faith. One time we had over 3 hours of discussions on this whole idea of faith and just went back and forth, and it was annoying, but it was also very interesting and enlightening as well. So we're going to be talking about that, but not for 3 hours, just for about 10 minutes. And we're going to talk about some other fun stuff. So here we go, straight into it. Once again, his name is Jeremy Chappell, and let's get to it. And I have the great pleasure of speaking with my good friend, Jeremy Chappell. How you doing, Jeremy?
I'm doing well, Bo. How about yourself?
I'm doing great. It's good to talk to you again, and I really appreciate you doing this and getting on the podcast.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I enjoy it.
I know you do, and that's why you're here. Well, I wanted to start out by basically, why don't you just introduce yourself to our audience?
Okay. Well, as you said, my name is Jeremy Chappell. I'm actually I work in a crime lab in the Kansas City area. I'm a crime scene supervisor there. So I've actually been in the forensic science field for about 10 years now, in different capacities. I've worked as a crime scene investigator and a forensic photographer, and now slightly more administrative position as a supervisor. So that's what I do. But in my spare time, I enjoy debating controversial issues, as you well know. probably the one that I'm most passionate about was debating the existence of God and all things related to that.
Yeah.
But I will emphasize, though, even as a public servant, that my opinions are my own.
Okay. That's good that you qualified that. All right. And if you can, take a few minutes and talk about your spiritual journey, if you want to call it that. How were you born and raised, and where are you now?
I think it's an interesting story anyway, but my parents were kind of polar opposites in a sense. When my dad was from the South, he was a Baptist, and my mom was from the North, she was a Catholic. And so when they got married, they kind of had to make that work a little bit. So shortly after they had me, I think they tried to kind of find something in the middle. So they ended up at a Methodist church, and I don't remember, obviously I was a little young, but from then it kind of just ended up being like a trail of different churches and different denominations that continued all the way into my adolescence as their faith kind of evolved and their beliefs changed. You know, they would change churches, and so I actually had quite the exposure to a lot of different church traditions, Christian traditions. So I've been in everything from Methodist, Catholic, Nazarene, Baptist, independent, non-denominational, you name it, I've probably been in it. Pentecostal, Charismatic.
Did you ever handle any snakes?
Never handled any snakes, thankfully, although I have had people falling down and screaming out in tongues and saying that they were prophesying. And yeah, I've had some interesting experiences for sure. So it's definitely given me an appreciation for the variety of the Christian spectrum. So, but for myself, I grew up as a Christian. I always was in that, mindset, I guess you could say. And so I never really had a dramatic conversion that a lot of people have later in life, where they, might have been, living the crazy life or,
right,
having all kinds of problems, and then they would convert, and then seemingly everything would get better. And so they would attribute that to their conversion to Christianity. I never had a dramatic personal or what you might call spiritual or religious experience like that. It was just something that I was always in. And probably just the way I'm wired a little bit, I've always just, kind of nitpicked at it and examined it, asked questions and stuff. And, as a kid, I would do that, and nobody ever really had a problem with it at all, but I was always fairly satisfied with the answers. Mm-hmm. Until, then I would get a little bit older and then decide, maybe that wasn't such a great answer. But as a kid, you tend to trust the people that are in leadership positions and especially your parents and stuff like that. So I was always convinced that there were answers to my questions. I just kind of needed to find them. So I really did evolve as, from a kid who definitely literally believed in a, 6-day creation, literal Genesis type of situation to, someone who entered into college and was already, very much skeptical of that. And then, by the time he exited college, was convinced that was definitely not true and that there were some significant other issues with his worldview till, now, 10, 12 years after that, where, it's definitely progressed to where, I'm convinced most of that is just a myth. And, that's pretty much where I'm at now. But I do still have a great amount of respect for the Christian tradition. And in a lot of ways, I'd probably still identify as a Christian just from the standpoint of I'd probably still be more comfortable in a room full of church-going Christians than I might be in a room full of atheists. But but at a certain point, you know, I was having enough conversations with people that I was realizing that, you know, I am arguing against Christians as much as I might argue with them. And at a certain point, you know, kind of have to admit that if you disagree with them on almost everything, then there isn't a whole lot of meaning to the label. You know, if I still identify as a Christian, but I disagree with almost everything that that they say they stand for, then maybe the label needs to change.
Yeah. Now, Jeremy, I don't know if you remember, but when we first met via the Debate God chat board, I started with a position of Christian non-theism, is what I called it.
Yeah, I do remember that.
Right, and I came from a position of a Catholic, and I told my story a few times, so I'm not going to go into too much detail, and you know it as well. But basically, I was a Christian, I was a Catholic. I always identified as a Catholic, even though I really never questioned the belief. It was just kind of more of a cultural thing. And then, of course, I went into really the philosophical aspect of theology, and then I started to question, and I couldn't comfortably identify as a Catholic anymore. But I still did, in a sense, identify with Christianity. That's why I wrote an entire book about trying to explain this and calling it Christian non-theism, where I still identified as a Christian. And I tried, basically, to tie my non-belief of the literal stories of the Bible and my disbelief in God into Christianity. And I thought I had it for a while, but eventually it all fell apart. And it probably with the help of you and many atheists on there who would just question me, because I was kind of in the middle. What changed it for me, what got me over that line, is I really looked at the tenets of Christianity and what Christianity is about. The whole idea of Christianity, accepting that we're sinned and we're flawed. And I had a list of like 10 things. And I just said, I just can't do it. It is not part of my value system. And that's what did it in for me.
Yeah. You know, and as I'm sure you remember too, you know, it becomes problematic sometimes too, when you identify with the label, people will assume that they know what that means.
Right.
You know, so if you talk to a Baptist or a Catholic or, you know, whoever, you know, and you identify as a Christian, or at least you don't, you know, actively, you know, refute it or something like that, you know, they will definitely make assumptions about what you believe. And when you don't share those assumptions, then it becomes an argument sometimes of,
right,
well, you're not really a Christian. And, right, you know, at a certain point, you just lose patience with trying to argue as to why that's, you know, nonsense or why that might not be or something like that. And it's just, at a certain point, it becomes not worth arguing about it anymore, and you just kind of give up and be like, fine, I'm not a Christian.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's like, where do you draw the line? You're listening to the Humanist Hour. This is Bo Bennett, and I'm speaking with Mr. Jeremy Chappell, talking about God, faith, and everything else. Well, let's talk about Christianity for a moment and look at some of the tenets. How would you define Christianity? This is probably an unfair question, because you, like me, know that there's a big sliding scale and there is no one definition of Christianity. But if there is one tenet to Christianity that you're either a Christian or not a Christian, is there something like that? And what is it, if there is?
Yeah, it's you know, it will differ, you know, depending on who you ask, if it's a Catholic or a Greek Orthodox or you know, like I said, an independent, you know, Southern Baptist church in the South or something like that. But you know, I think pretty much everyone that is a Christian would agree that if you are a Christian, you are focused on the figure of Christ. You are a Christ follower. That's, I think that's pretty much literally what the term Christian means. At least that's what it originally meant. So in that sense, if you consider yourself a follower of Christ, then you can legitimately claim to be a Christian. Of course, the problem becomes into, like, if you claim that you're a follower of Christ, then people have all kinds of expectations that, well, you can't be a follower of Christ and believe in gay marriage, or you know, you can't be a follower of Christ and believe in abortion. Well, why not? Well, because the Holy Spirit would be working in you and would tell you that those things are wrong, or, you know, so and so on. So it becomes more complicated immediately. And then, of course, there's all kinds of scripture and traditions that become packaged into it. And in fairness, if you're going to say that you're a follower of Christ, well, where would you, you have to have some kind of understanding of who Jesus was. And you're only going to get that from Scripture. You're only going to get that from the Gospels. So on some level, if you say you're a follower of Christ, you're going to have to agree with what's in there. Even if it's somewhat selective, it doesn't mean much to say that you're a follower of Christ and not believe anything that's in the Gospels.
Sure. So wouldn't it be even more general to say that if you do not believe in Jesus was God, then you can't be a Christian?
Well, there's definitely people who would say that. I think that's very debatable, because it is at least somewhat debatable that the earliest followers of Christ may not have seen him as God or did. I think as soon as you start using the label Christian, I think, even in that general sense that I was describing, you then have to start qualifying whether or not it's an orthodox view or a not non-orthodox view, because then that will be at least helpful for other people to understand where you're coming from. And of course, to some people, if you say non-orthodox, that immediately disqualifies you from being a Christian anyway, but at least it helps. So, but you can obviously be a follower of a certain person and not believe that they're God.
Sure.
You can be a Buddhist and not believe Buddha was God. You can, you can be, they would probably be debatable as to whether or not you could be a Muslim and not believe Muhammad was a prophet or something like that. But I don't know how they exactly have how some of those how Muslims nuance their beliefs sometimes, but I do think you can be a Christian and not necessarily be convinced that Jesus was God. I just you would have to be able to you'd have to be prepared to have all those conversations that we were referring to earlier about other people saying, oh no, you're not really a Christian. I will say that if you don't believe that Jesus was God, it's probably going to be a really liberal, for the lack of a better term, or watered down, is what a conservative might say. It's going to be a very general type of Christianity that is not going to probably be identifiable with very many, I guess.
Right.
I would say.
Let's talk about God. You still consider yourself at this point a theist, right?
I mean,
that's okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you have a belief in a God. Now let's operationally define God, because of course, when you say, yeah, I believe in God, everybody can mean something different. Some people mean, oh, like a big force of the universe. Some people, you know what everybody means. I mean, there's so many definitions out there. So to you, if we were to break down this idea of God, at the very minimum, what does it take to be God?
That's a good question. And I think if I was just going to be really honest with you, I'd have to say, I don't know. I've gone around this question a lot of different times. I think I think it was Michael Shermer and maybe other people have said the same thing, that basically God would be indistinguishable from like a really powerful alien. Any technology that's sufficiently superior to ours might appear to us to be godlike. And I think that's a good point. So I don't know would be the honest answer. And I think that a lot of people go about it the wrong way. And I don't know if wrong is necessarily the right way to phrase that. But the way I go about it is I kind of look at it like solving for X. Mm-hmm. And the analogy I compare, and it may be a flawed one, the analogy I compare is kind of like dark matter, where people were observing things about the universe or the cosmos, and they were noticing, kind of this lurking mysterious substance that should be there, but for whatever reason they couldn't identify it. And so they just kind of label it dark matter and try to find out more about it.
Right.
That's kind of how I view the search for God, if you will, or God. God is X. I don't know what God is. And so in that sense, I can't say that he's worthy of worship.
Gotcha.
But I do think that there is an X And it seems somewhat godlike to me in the sense that, yeah, I do think it's probably something like what a lot of people say God should be, in the sense that I do think that he's probably, or she, would be responsible for, the universe coming into being. So in that sense, like I said, the technology would be sufficiently more powerful than ours that I would feel comfortable calling it God.
Right.
But I can't necessarily tell you that God is all loving. I can't necessarily tell you that God is omniscient or all powerful or, you know, whatever you want to say. You know, those things are to me those are the three probably most traditional godlike attributes, at least in Western civilization for the last few thousand years. But I don't know that those are necessarily requirements for God.
It seems to me that you have a deistic point of view as opposed to a theistic. But I guess the big difference is, do you see this force, this X, God, whatever, still at work in the universe today?
I would say that in my own life, there have been times where I was, as a Christian, who was willing to attribute a lot of things to God that I might not be as willing to attribute now. There were plenty of times where I thought God was at work, and now I look back on it and I can easily rationalize it other ways.
Right.
That doesn't necessarily mean God wasn't at work, though. I don't necessarily see God at work in my life at all. In the sense that, like I said, I can easily rationalize everything that I used to attribute to God to some other force, some other cause. But that becomes easy. It becomes easy to rationalize things too.
Sure.
I guess where I might differ with a lot of atheists or even maybe some deists is that I do give some merit to other people's religious experiences, in the sense that I don't know what it's like to have a lot of the experiences that people claim to have. Mm-hmm. I just never shared in those experiences. So I don't fully understand it. But because of that, because I never had those myself, and therefore I can't just wave it off like, oh, I had that, it's nothing. I'm not willing to just poo-poo it either. And I do know that, theists from all, different kinds of religions have similar types of religious experiences, which kind of clues a lot of people in or makes a lot of people think that it's not necessarily a spiritual thing or a God thing, but it's more like a human mind thing. And then I'm not necessarily denying that either. But to me, if you were just kind of look at it abductively, you would say, if God exists and if God is at work in this present world, would you expect people to have what they call religious experiences? And you would, and people do claim to have them. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, I'm not going to deny that God is at work. I will just say, I don't necessarily think that the evidence is overwhelming either, as far as miracles go.
Right, right. Yeah, you did mention an important point, and that's if you look at the common element that we all share, people of all different cultures, all different beliefs, it is the human mind. And with a psychology background, it's very, to me at least, I understand it. I could understand these religious experiences. I understand not the ultimate source, of course, because you could say, what is the ultimate source? And then you could say, you could always posit a God. For example, you said, if there were a God, would you expect these kind of experiences? And, you could say yes, but you could also say, if there were a human mind that worked in this way, would you expect these kind of experiences? And you could also say yes.
Yeah, I don't know that on a purely naturalistic view, if people weren't already having them, that you would necessarily say, yes, I would predict that, people would believe in God and that they would attribute experiences to them. Mm-hmm. That's only part of the story. There's prior probability and then there's, probability after the fact.
Right.
And I'm not familiar enough with all of the evidence to render an opinion one way or another. I do think that, like you're a lot more familiar with the psychological aspects of it than I am. I do think there's probably plenty of evidence in the realms of psychology and neuroscience to cast doubt on a lot of religious experiences after the fact. But I do think that, you know, just given naturalism and given those kinds of assumptions, that religious experience is probably a more surprising type of scenario.
Sure.
But that doesn't mean that you can't account for them.
Right. Okay. So it seems like religious experience is probably something that you're still holding on to with a little bit of, I guess, skepticism, but opposite skepticism. Skepticism that it's not a fully, or it might not be a fully naturalistic process. And that's understandable.
Yeah, I don't think we understand it completely.
Which we don't.
I don't think we understand it well enough, I guess I should say.
I would say that we do understand it well enough at this point to not have to attribute it to a god or a supernatural source. How about the deistic god? I know that you're, at least in our talks before, you still have this sense that the universe or everything that exists, it's more probable to you that some being created it as opposed to it kind of always being here.
Is that accurate?
Yes.
Okay. So, and here's the issue that I have with that, Jeremy. It's the whole fact that we're just kind of pushing it back one. And we've had this discussion before, like, okay, it's okay to accept that some powerful being has always been around, but it's not okay to accept that everything has always been around. And it seems like we're going out on a limb to posit this all-powerful being when it doesn't, it's just like an extra step we're throwing in there unnecessarily.
Well, that's I think that's the key right there. Is it necessary to do it, or is it not necessary to do it? In my own thinking, it does seem necessary to do it. And the reason for that being is just because if you, follow a logical, chain of events backwards, eventually you're going to need a first cause. If you follow, a Kalam type argument, you know, you're going to need that initial creative step. The problem I have with the universe just always being here is that you're going to end up having to basically appeal to mystery in the same way that a theist appeals to mystery with God. So in that point, I guess you could say, well, what's the difference? The difference is just to be that one, I guess, makes more sense to me than the other.
Right. Well, I would say that the difference is with the universe, we know it's here.
Well, sure. Yeah. But you don't know that it was there with the different types of conditions. Like, for instance, if you had assumed that the universe was always there with the current, you know, natural laws that we have now, then, you know, with entropy being what it is, then we should already be in, you know, a state of permanent, you know, entropic death or something like that, you know, like, because so at some point the second law came into being, because we're not at that state point. That second law of thermodynamics hasn't always been there. The same thing with other different laws. So just the fact that they've started, and then you have different scenarios like fine tuning or stuff like that, where that I'm dragging a whole other argument into the process, but it just seems to point to a causal process to me, with there being only, and this is the tricky part, with there only being maybe a few clues as to what the properties of that, you know, causal entity might be. So, you know, and I know that they've done a lot of work recently, like people like Lawrence Krauss and Stephen Hawking, and I am not even remotely qualified to critique their work. All I know is just from what I've read on both sides of the spectrum with atheists and theists alike is that it all kind of centers around, you know, what your definition of nothing is going to be. And those, what a Stephen Hawking or what a Larry Krauss is going to attribute, or what they're going to call nothing, is not going to be the same thing that a philosopher is going to call nothing. And so, you know, like you said, an atheist is going to have to believe that something was always there. And I guess in that sense, we're kind of in agreement, because kind of like what I said, I think you're kind of solving for X.
Right.
So we're all kind of in agreement that there's this X that was always there. So the question is what are the properties?
What are the properties of X exactly?
To be?
Exactly. And I think that's very interesting, because when we break it down like this, as you pointed out, we have very similar beliefs. It's just a matter of probably how we define these terms that we're using, coming from our different cultural backgrounds and the way we were brought up and so forth, and maybe the labels we currently identify with in our lives.
The interesting thing to me is, having kind of said, even though it does seem to me more likely that, rather than it just being fluctuations of quantum particles that were always there, for eternity, a being or something like that. Once you kind of admit, like I have, that you don't know
right.
what that X might be, I've had more than one person tell me, well, you're just functionally atheist then, which I kind of laugh at, which I'm like, I get it. Like, I know why they're calling that, but then I'm just kind of like, how do you know you're not functionally theist? Yeah. Because like you said, like it's really just kind of the same, our beliefs are so similar, but,
right.
But once you do kind of admit that I know enough about the properties of this being or this X to say that, oh yeah, you should definitely worship it. Then yeah, you essentially kind of become like what you said, like maybe a deist or, even quote unquote functionally atheist.
You're listening to The Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett, and we're speaking with Mr. Jeremy Chappell. Okay, well, let's move on from this idea of X, which I think appears that the only difference is you think more probabilistically that this X is some kind of being, whereas I say the X is actually just probably, some kind of force that existed. And what is the difference between a force and some ultimately powerful being that we can't even imagine?
Mm-hmm.
It's like the line is so thin, but and it's funny too, because I undoubtedly identify with atheism as an atheist, but it's essentially the same thing. It's crazy. All right, well, let's move on to one of the issues that we talked about before. We had a 3-hour debate or conversation about this in the past, and that was the whole idea of faith. Now, unfortunately, Jeremy, we don't have 3 hours this time. We've got about 10 minutes. So, and I don't know where you are on this issue anymore, and I don't know if you'd be pushing for it as hard as you did when we talked a couple years ago. Let's talk about your own definition of faith and what it means, or perhaps what it meant to you, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, I think it's a very, very important to distinguish between two things. There's faith, how an atheist or how a skeptic, somebody from the outside looking in, perceives it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is, faith and how the adherent, conceives of it. And the reason I distinguish between those two things is because I think where the criticism of faith comes in is to people's perceptions of it. And the people's perceptions of it is not the same way as the Christian or the Jew or the Muslim or whoever. That is not how they conceive of it. And so they defend their conception while at the same time maybe ignoring their practice.
Right. Well, can we say that it's fair to say that there are groups of Christians or Jews or people of different religions that do hold the position of faith, maybe like an extreme position of faith, that the way that most or many atheists characterize faith, that we can't make a blanket statement saying that all Christians or all Jews don't have that kind of faith?
Yes. There are Christians out there, and I've debated them myself, even when I was a Christian, mm-hmm. who will tell you when you ask for evidence or, you know, or ask why or something like that, they will just tell you, oh, well, you know, you just have to have faith.
Right.
And I think that is the fair criticism that a lot of atheists are leveling against, you know, Christians in particular, but other faiths as well. And I would join them in that refrain with that criticism. But then there's also a significant group of faith traditions that don't conceive of faith in that way, and it kind of takes on a noun and a verb terminology, I guess you could say. Whereas faith is basically synonymous with belief or the practice of believing. And that belief is, in my opinion, inevitably based on evidence, even if we all disagree on what evidence is or how good that evidence is. And the reason why I say that is because at some point, the person, even though they might be saying, oh, well, you just got to believe, even though they're saying it in a way that it basically implies that, oh, you don't need evidence or you don't have evidence, that person believes for some reason, and that reason to them is evidence for them. Granted, it is completely subjective, but they're not believing for no reason.
Right. Even if the reason is fallacious, let's say an appeal to authority.
Exactly.
Right. Their parents said, you have to believe this, so they believe because their parents told them and they trust their parents.
Exactly right. Or it may just be completely because they assume that the Bible is the word of God.
Right.
And so they believe everything that's in it. To them, that's evidence. So they believe it. So it's still, even when somebody says, oh, you just got to believe for no reason, mm-hmm. it's still an evidence-based belief. I think the discussion at that point needs to, instead of just trying to argue over what faith is and just trying to bash, you know, for lack of a better word, the Christian for not having evidence-based beliefs, I think the conversation needs to move, why do you think this is good evidence?
Right.
And that's how I have approached the issue anyway. Right. But yeah, to me, and I gave this example to you numerous times, to me, faith has always been the act of believing even though you're not completely certain. So, and then the example I always give is a chair. Mm-hmm. You may have sat down in a chair 1,000 times, so you have very good reasons for believing that that chair can support your weight. However, there's always that possibility that on the 1,000th and first time, you sit in that chair and it's going to crumble or snap or whatever. So every time you sit in that chair, every time you sit in that chair, you are exercising, however small, just a little bit of faith in that chair.
Right.
And to me, that's what faith is. And of course, there are varying degrees of it.
Sure.
You know, if my 18-month-old or 19-month-old daughter, you know, strung a few sticks together and wanted me to sit on it, and I honestly expected it to withstand my weight, you know, I would be exercising a lot more faith and probably an unwarranted amount of faith in sure. that particular structure. So that's where I think that the conversation needs to go. I think, honestly, that the criticism and the outrage over just the idea of faith is misplaced. I think you have to acknowledge at some point that we are all just in disagreement over what constitutes good evidence.
I think that's a great point. And as we talked about before, when you mentioned the chair example, we kind of get into the whole problem of induction. And one of the common examples is the sun rising. You know, the sun rises always in the past. Will it rise tomorrow? We don't know. But out of probability, we could say that it does rise. And when you relate that to something else that people have faith in religiously, we could see a big difference. Like, is the sun going to rise tomorrow? Well, let's say we have faith, and I put that in quotes, that it will. Did Jesus walk on water 2,000 years ago? Well, I have faith that he did. Same thing. You know, no, it's not the same thing.
So I think that's another great point. So for the atheist, the line, or maybe not all atheists, but you know what I mean, mm-hmm. skeptics and stuff, for those people that are trying to make this argument, the line for them is probably basically where not faith is those inductive conclusions that you make that are warranted. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not faith. And then when you move into these unwarranted claims, well, that's obviously faith. It's bad. And the problem is you become kind of begging the question at that point, where you're defining faith as automatically being unwarranted conclusions. You know, and so that's where the Christians and whoever, the apologists, come back and start arguing, you know, like, well, you're just assuming the very thing in question. And they do have a legitimate point there sometimes. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think it would be fine if you just wanted to say that, you know, like, say, my faith in the chair, if you don't want to call it faith, because, well, it's not a religious thing. You know, like, I'm not going to, you know, I think it's fine if you want to say that faith has to be somewhat religious.
Right.
I get that. I'm fine with that. You know, like, I don't have faith in the chair, but I have faith, like you said, in Jesus walking on the water or something like that, where the difference is only that we want to make faith more of a religious term. But obviously nobody's going to object to the term or the idea based solely on the fact that it refers to something religious either, because then again, you'd be kind of assuming the thing in question.
Right, right. But wouldn't it be fair to say that there are many sections in the Bible that talk about this idea of faith, the biblical faith is what I call it, like a believing just because. For example, the whole story of doubting Thomas and the fact that he was the one who doubted, where blessed are you if you don't require the kind of evidence. I know there are many sections in the Bible that talk about that kind of faith. So do you think it's unfair that many people who know the Bible could look at that and say, well, it looks like this is what Christian faith is, or this is what it's supposed to be?
I think, honestly, Bo, I don't know if I would go so far as to say that there are many sections of the Bible that refer to faith in that way. I do think that there are some sections where it gives that impression superficially, and a very good example is the one that you mentioned with doubting Thomas. I think that with doubting Thomas, it's very easy to look at it in a very different way. We're not very different, but mm-hmm. slightly different. And again, it moves the discussion back to how I said, which is, what do you consider good evidence? If you approach the issue, and obviously we can debate as whether or not this is the correct way to approach it, but if you were to approach it based on the way that the gospel writer is writing his story, which is that Thomas has been there for how many miracles that Jesus has performed, how many times Jesus predicted that he would be crucified or die at least. And I can't remember. I think the doubting Thomas story is in John or Luke. I can't remember.
John.
You know, in some gospels, he even kind of hints at the fact that he might come back. Were you to have sat through all these miracles, walking on water, healing the sick, bringing the dead back to life, is the fact that you would only believe that he has come back to life when you see it for yourself, is that a reasonable thing? And of course, we can debate that and say, mm-hmm. you know, well, yeah, that's perfectly reasonable because that's outrageous. But the Christian at that point, or the follower of Jesus at that point, what Thomas is being implicitly criticized as, I guess you could say, is that maybe his level of skepticism is just a little too high based on all the experiences that he's had. You can look at it that way. Right. But I'm not going to criticize someone who kind of sees it initially, at least. I think the most straightforward or the most immediately obvious way of reading it is that Thomas was supposed to believe and he didn't. Mm-hmm. So I would be willing to kind of chalk that one up to a different, you know, like I said, a more loose based faith, I guess you could say. The other one to me is in Hebrews, where it talks about faith and what it is and who has it. It's a very, very famous passage. And it begins with, by faith we understand that, God created the heavens and the earth, basically. And I think that is, to me, that was always the most puzzling when I was making my case mm-hmm. For why faith is just, it can be perfectly consistent with evidence-based belief. That was always the most troublesome passage for me, because in that passage, and it's the only one that I know of that's similar to that, that passage makes faith sound like some kind of mystically obtained knowledge. Right. By faith we understand
Gotcha.
That this or that happened. It makes it sound like the only way you would know that is because of faith, which, you know, so it's some kind of religiously obtained knowledge that you wouldn't otherwise have. Very Gnostic idea to me. That to me is the most, that was always the most troublesome passage. So yeah, there are at least a few passages that make faith out to be, you know, something different than right. what I would say, for
well,
sure.
Well, let's look at the big picture. And many people believe, many Christians believe, and in fact, I don't even know if I would, maybe the majority of Christians believe, that faith is required for salvation. You know, of course, there's this whole idea of faith and works. Now, if faith does not mean a belief without sufficient evidence, or belief without enough warrant for the belief, or however you want to phrase it, what exactly is faith? Or is the Bible saying that if you don't have enough evidence, you're going to go to hell? You're not going to be saved?
It's a great question. Even in the two juxtaposed passages where James is emphasizing the works aspect of faith, and Paul in Romans and elsewhere emphasizes the, you know, more belief-centered approach, the more like mental ascent aspect of faith, I guess you could call it. They still both, even though they're emphasizing opposite sides of the coin, they still both agree that there's supposed to be actions in appropriation with your belief, that they go somewhat hand in hand, even if they disagree on which one is to be emphasized. And so in that sense, I think you can argue that any kind of salvation or faith and works type of debate is automatically misplaced because the two go hand in hand. But the fact is that people have these kinds of debates all the time, so we might as well talk about it. But the Bible is not saying that, you know, that salvation is that you have to have enough evidence for belief, otherwise you're going to go to hell or something like that. The Bible, at least in Romans, Paul makes it very clear that everyone has this evidence. In Romans 1, he makes that very clear. At least this is what he thinks anyway.
Right.
Everyone has this evidence. You just choose to believe it or you don't believe it. And this is, I think, one of, I don't know if I want to call it a fatal flaw, but definitely a drawback, I guess you could say, to some Christian conceptions of salvation, where you almost have to believe that the reason why atheists or non-Christians are going to go to hell is because they are actively resisting the idea of Jesus being God or Christianity being true, however you want to phrase it.
Right.
I think it's Schellenberg that makes his divine hiddenness argument against theism by phrasing it in those terms, that if God is all loving, there would be no non-resistant believers, and there are non-resistant believers, therefore there is no all-loving God. Obviously, that's probably extremely watered down, and I'm sure as a philosopher, his was much better. But that is the general gist of the argument. And so I think, Christians have a lot of explaining to do in that sense as to, are you just going to argue that even though we say that I would be open to the idea of believing in God or believing that Jesus died for my sins or whatever like that, I just don't see enough evidence for it? Or are you going to argue that, no, there is enough evidence for it, you're just not seeing it yet? That's an interesting dilemma, for the Christian, for sure.
Right. What always impressed me about you, Jeremy, is you're incredibly reasoned, level-headed. And even when we disagree, you always had some really good points that just made me say, crap, you know, I hate this guy. He's just so damn smart.
I think, the one thing that I think that I learned more than anything with our debates was, because I came into it definitely as a more apologetic type of approach, where I was convinced I was right and I was convinced everybody else was being unreasonable, where, man, it is such a gray area to me anyway now, where like just looking at the evidence, you can meet to me anyway, just easily see it both ways. And so it's interesting in that sense as to why people will argue one way or another.
Well, I said it before, what I appreciate most about people and respect about people is their critical thinking and their skepticism, and whether that brings them to specific beliefs, whether they're Republican, Democrat, Christian, atheist, whether they're pro-abortion or pro-life, it doesn't matter to me. What does matter is how they got there and their whole process of getting there. And I think that you certainly exemplify that whole idea. So, Jeremy, I appreciate it so much, and I appreciate you coming on and sharing some of your ideas with us. This has been great.
It was my pleasure, Bo. Thanks for having me on.
All right, thank you. You take care.
I will. You too.
All right, folks, that'll do it for this week's Humanist Hour. I hope you enjoyed it. If you do have any feedback, feel free to email us at humanisthour@americanhumanist.org or leave a message on our voice feedback line, 202-618-1371. Again, my name is Bo Bennett. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time on the Humanist Hour. Bye-bye.